Hello and welcome back to Heard and Not Seen, a podcast from Barnardo's. This episode marks the start of our oral history project, a new series that looks at the unheard stories of post-war African and Caribbean communities in the UK, often referred to as the Windrush generation. The project is about capturing and sharing the experiences of those who came to Britain in this period, and who made an incredible contribution to every part of our national life, including to Barnardo's. Before we dive into our first history, here's a short peek at what's coming up in this series.
I don't have a picture of me with my mother. I never thought about that. I didn't have a picture of my mother with me until I was in my 40s, when I reconnected with her. No. Hello, my name's Tony, and I'm a successful business executive. The word mother just seems strange to me. But the strange thing is, it's not something I'd even think about. For me, I've always just been me. I don't even think of parents. People know me as someone who helps some of the world's leading media groups, sports organisations and entertainment groups perform their very best. But there's something about me that many of my friends and colleagues don't know. I hadn't been into somebody's home, as in a house, until I was probably seven.
You'd never been in a family home?
No.
Until you were 7 years old?
I hadn't even thought about it until that second. No, never. As in a front door, seeing somebody's, what a lounge looked like, or a kitchen, or anything like that. No. For the first 16 years of my life, I was in care. My home was Barnardo's. I'm one of the last generation of lifers, actually. I think from the day I went in October 1961, if somebody said, Tony won't leave here until July 1977, they'd have probably thought, really? That's a long term, isn't it, really? It is a long term.
My name is Paul, and I've known Tony for over 20 years. As a radio producer, he asked me to help him tell his story, the story that he now feels able to share. And that meant diving deep into the records held by the institutions that were his life.
They gave me everything because they kept everything. I'm so well documented. It's unbelievable. I'm an item as opposed to a human. All of this paperwork on my lap is, instead of a mother or father figure and the memory they'd have had in their mind, illnesses and things like that, measles, mumps, what age I learned to walk, all these sort of things are all in here. But it doesn't value any memory above anything else. It's just all chronological. It meant going back to the homes I lived in, and the very institution in which I was born.
You see, a lot of people...
Gosh, this is it. Was I born on this road? Oh, my God. Do you know what? I probably haven't been down this road since Adele's taken out.
Here it is. Your destination is on the left.
Oh, my gosh.
It meant visiting the headquarters of the organisations that acted as his guardians.
It's still a residential site, so the cadets who come in for training, they live here for 2 years.
Wow. It's really strange. When we walked into the Salvation Army headquarters in London, it was really weird. I felt, gosh, I'm from here. I felt I probably have more claim to that building than any of them. So I was born in one. They all chose to work there.
It's a lovely building, and it was refurbished about 10 years ago. It's a really good mixture.
And it meant remembering what I could about the family that put me into care. I'm described in this piece of paper as a coloured child, and that's underlined, and it talks about the background of my family and how they came to the UK, but they were hardworking people. My grandmother came to the UK in 57, and she was part of what would have been called the Windrush generation, and she actually came on a boat, and she came to Green Lane in Birmingham. I think my mother was young. She was very young.
How young?
15. New country. New experiences. In one generation, they made a big jump. If my grandmother was at the pearly gates, I guess he'd say she'd been a success. And I was probably just collateral damage to that success. But most of all, it meant revisiting my 16 years in the care homes I lived in and the memories I've taken with me. There's four children in the photo, all under six, and we're all black. I think Oakley House saved me in many ways. it gave me a stability and a peace that I probably wouldn't have got anywhere else. It sounds a bit melodramatic, but I felt safe. It's really interesting. When I saw the film Hook, the one with Robin Williams, I was in bits watching it. It just took me back to there. The world they went to was my world, and I knew it so well. And I think for many children growing up in care, those first 6 or 7 years aren't that devastating. It's what happens after that. And then it's like the lights go out. I can't remember anything from my first couple of years in Birmingham.
You can't live a life like this and not be affected. But I'm doing it because I'm just tired of seeing clever kids, kids with no hope and sadness.
It has been a painful journey, but one I've had to make for myself, my family, and for all of those who have been through and are still in the care system.
In this series of podcasts for Barnardo's and their Oral History Project, we hope this story will give comfort to those with similar experiences and shine a light on a world many just don't know about. It does strike me that you have a remarkable memory.
Yeah, I do, actually. A lot of people comment on it because my memory is all I have. If I didn't remember, nobody ever would. What is interesting about all of this, Paul, is when I talk about this, none of the people I know now who I grew up with have ever asked me about my life in a home. No one has ever asked me. Now, it may be that I've never made people feel comfortable enough to do that, but no, nobody.
It may also be that they just don't know.
No, I don't tell people either. That probably helps.
Keep an eye out for the rest of Tony's story, which we'll be sharing along with others over the coming months. Today we're kicking it off with a special episode from our very own Vice President, Baroness Floella Benjamin. Born in Trinidad and Tobago in 1949, Floella has gone on to do it all. She's an actress, author, television presenter, singer, businesswoman and politician. And she currently holds a life peerage in the House of Lords as none other than Baroness Benjamin of Beckenham. Hers is an inspiring story about overcoming challenge and hardship. Her interview is conducted by Ola, who is supported by our Youth Build Academy in Lewisham. Enjoy.
When growing up, did you grow up on with your mum? Like, when she came over here, did you grow up with her, or was she already... I sure already stayed there for, like, a bit before you came?
Well, my father left Trinidad in 1958. My father was a bit of an activist. He was somebody who fought for people's rights, and he was fighting for the workers' rights, because at the time, the black people in Trinidad, in the Caribbean, they didn't have many rights, and he thought it was unjust. And he realized that it was going to be difficult living in a country like this. Plus, he wanted to play jazz. He was a musician. He wanted to play jazz. So he decided to come to England. So in 1958, he came to England. A year later, my mum came and joined him and left me and my sister and my two other brothers, left us with two of the most awful foster parents in the world. And she took my two younger brothers, my brother and sister, with her. But we had to stay behind for 15 months. And it was 15 months of hell. I think that's why I fight so much for children in care, children who don't have their parents around them. The only way I survived was knowing I was loved. My mum and my dad told me every day how much they loved us. And when you have love, when you feel as if you belong, when you feel everything's going to get better, eventually you can survive. And that's how I survived those 15 months. And when I came to England, I was so happy because we were back together as a family, even though we lived in one room. All eight of us, six children, mum and dad, we lived in one room. But my mum used to say, this room is full of love. And children need to know they're loved. And as I was saying, my foster parents weren't particularly nice. But because for the first 8 years of my life, I knew I was loved, I could survive anything.
How did she get through the racism that people go due to her and stuff like that?
You have to believe in yourself. And you have to hold your head up high. I'm sure you're not going to give up. Because when you think of Caribbean people, especially, what we have been through, what my ancestors have been through, we were dragged from our villages in Africa. We were shackled together. If you weren't strong, you were dead, you were gone. You were put on a ship across the Atlantic Ocean, packed like sardines. If you weren't strong, you were dead, you were gone. You were thrown overboard if you got ill. When you got to the Caribbean, you were scattered around. You lost your name, you lost your culture, you lost your family because you did not, mums, dads, brothers, sisters weren't together as a family. So I know that I am a survivor. And if my ancestors could survive all of that, I could survive anything that's thrown at me. And my mother taught me that. My mother was a survivor. My father, they were survivors. My mum used to say to us every day, education is your passport to life. You go to school and you learn, because once you have an education, no one can take it away from you. And one day you will grow up to change the world with that education. Now, when you have that mantra, when you have that mission in life, when you have that philosophy, you can face anything. If anybody's racist towards you, you think, well, can't you see what I'm worth? When you have that confidence, can't you see I'm worthy? And in fact, when I came to Britain, I used to fight a lot. And I had a spiritual moment at the age of 14 when I realized that if someone didn't like the color of my skin, it was their problem, not mine. I was going to forge my way forward without any hatred in my heart, without any resentment, but totally focused, totally in tune with what I'm supposed to do. And that's what my mother and my father did.
It's really hard to do what you want to do when everyone brings you down, especially if they just see what you're worth just from your skin. Once they see your skin, they just automatically bring you down.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's tough being black, but you've got to realize that it's like human beings always find prejudice about something. And when you're a black person, it's easy for people to pick on the color of your skin because immediately they know what to target. And because you know that, you must not look at life through their eyes, because you are one step ahead of them. You know how they might perceive you. You know what they might think of you. And you have got to leapfrog all of that by not taking it on. The moment you take it on is the moment they've won. The moment you react to what they're saying you racially is the moment they've won. When I got a post once, a role where it was quite high profile, and someone said to me, well, you've only got that because you're black. They're being politically correct. And I said to her, well, you've only got to where you are in life because you're white. Now it's my turn. She didn't know what to say. She didn't know what to do. I didn't kind of justify why I got it. I just pointed out to her something that she may not have ever thought about. And so you have to be clever. Do not fall for it. Do not actually take the bait. And when they are prejudiced towards you, racist towards you, you have to think of a clever way, like Nelson Mandela, a clever way of how I'm going to get out of this situation. Like Mayor Angelo, a clever way of how you get out of this situation. A clever way of what you say to people so they start respecting you. And when you're this color, every day there it's a battle. Someone like myself, people might think, oh, she's successful, she's well off, she's established. Mm-mm. It's all relative. The higher you go, the bigger the burden, the more you have to face. So it's never easy. It hasn't been easy for me, but I've just shown people, you're not gonna get me, I'm a winner. You smile, because winners smile. If you get aggressive, if you want to fight, like I was fighting that day when I was 14, I realized then I could get into trouble because I could never win. I could never win it if I was fighting in that way. I fight with my brain. I fight with my smile. I fight with my intelligence and my intellect. And eventually you break them down and they come to you. People who were horrible to me when I was a child, who was racist to me as a child, who did wicked things to me as a child, they come to me today and they say, please forgive me. Please forgive me. I didn't realize what I was doing. And I go, there's nothing to forgive. You've learned your lesson. You've seen what life is all about eventually. And that's the secret. I'm telling you, young man, don't ever, ever, ever feel You're not worthy. Don't ever, ever let them see they've got to you. Don't ever, ever, ever give up. Because every disappointment is an appointment with something better. And you learn. You learn. You learn as you walk along that path. You're not going to get me. I am going to move forward. I'm not a victim. I'm a hero. And I can do this. And if you believe that every day, you have to believe it. It's got to come from here in your heart. You've got to believe it. Believe it. And when you believe it, you shine. Because people then see you're confident and they move out of your way. Move out of the way. Because they know. They know that you are special. They know that you are worthy. And no matter what they try how to do to get to you, you will not break you down. And I'm living proof of that.
If I'm being honest, it's been quite a tough battle, a tough road, because I was thinking to myself, what if I wasn't black, would this happen to me? What if this, what if that? But then I realized that I am black, that there's nothing I can change about that, you know? And then I started thinking, do you know what? If no one accepts me, I should accept myself. Because at this point, I'm just torturing myself. Like, mm-hmm. At this point, I just want to sleep, you know? I just want to have a nice day. So from then on, I just started smiling a lot and just trying to, like, enjoy life.
Yeah.
And then most people see me, look at me, and then they go, oh, Oladi, you're so jokey. I can't take you serious. But they don't know that the reason why I'm acting like that is just to force out the negativity in my heart.
I did that when I came to England because of my accent. I had a Trinidadian accent and I used to talk with my Trinidadian accent. Hey, what happening? Should we want to go down the road and do and thing? And my teacher, I had a teacher called Mrs. Thomas who was terribly, terribly posh. And she said to me, Flavella Benjamin, if you want to remain in my class, you learn to speak the Queen's English. And I had to cry because there she is embarrassing me in front of all the girls in the class. And she said, stop that snivelling, you gutter snipe, get into detention. And I went home and I cried, you know, when I said to my mum, the teacher told me off because she said, I've got to learn to speak the Queen's English. And my mother said, eh, I bring you to England for a teacher to tell you off. You go to school and you learn to speak the Queen's English. You hear me? Yes, mummy. Yes, mummy. And I went to school and I learned to speak the Queen's English. But this is a very important message I'm giving. I do a lot of lectures and a lot of inspirational talks. And I talk to young people and old people about understanding who they are and to tuning in to their spirit and to their soul and learn to do that. And every day you wake up and you look in the mirror and you say, I am worthy. I am worthy. I love who I am. I am worthy. World, I'm here to show you who I truly am. And every day you say that, every day you chant that, and you start believing it, and you start reacting and acting that way. And that's what I want you to do, Ola. After today, I want you to do that. So no matter what people say to you, what they do and say to you, nothing will get you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you a lot. I wish I had this conversation when that, you know, I wish I had this conversation when that was going on in my mind.
It's never too late. It's never too late.
Thank you. Thank you a lot.
And you pass that message on to other people.
I would definitely. I just want to ask you, why do you want to get involved with Barnardos?
Well, I've always been aware of the importance of making a difference to this world. My parents were like that. My mother was always helping other people. My father was always helping other people. And so I've grown up appreciating charities that help other people. And as I said, I was in a foster home back in Trinidad. And Barnardos always used to ask me to run marathons for them. And I used to say, no, I'm a short distance person. You know, I only do 100 meters or 200 meters. I don't do marathons. Don't be silly. And when I was coming up to my 50th birthday back in 1999, I'm 71 this year, which is fantastic. I love it. But back in 1999, I decided for my 50th birthday, I would run a marathon. So I said yes to Barnardos. And I did the marathon and I loved it. So I said to them, I'm going to do 10 consecutive London marathons for you. And for 10 years, I went out there and I ran the marathon and raised thousands and thousands of pounds for Barnardo's. Because Barnardo's do an incredible job with projects across the country to make children and families feel as if they are worthy and that there is a future for them. No matter who you are, where you've come from, we want to make sure you know where you're going. And that's why I support Barnardo's. And that's why I'm proud to be a vice president of Barnardo's. And whenever I have an opportunity in the House of Lords to talk about Barnardo's and talk about the work, I do so. And to make sure that other people can appreciate and support Barnardo's the way I think everybody should be doing, because they look after children and their families and they care. They truly care. So I hope that one day you'll be in a position where you could probably be the chief executive of Barnardo's. You give back. But the secret of life is to give back. Always give back. For the more you give, the more comes back to you in abundance.
You know what? I feel proud that, you know, that someone of asking color can get to where you are right now. It gives me hope that I can also do that. And probably even more. So when I see people of my color in higher places, I feel like that, you know, that at least there is a way, at least there is a door for me to shine, for me to fly, for me to spread my wings. Because every time I feel like I'm being shackled down, either by, you know, by money or by the skin of my color, or something else, you know. So every single time I feel like I'm able to remove one of the chains around me, I feel happy in a way.
Yeah, well, remember, I did a children's program called Play School I started in 1976. And when I started that program, I was just a young actress enjoying what I was doing. But what I didn't realize was that I was paving the way for future generations. The amount of people who say to me from all walks of life, all colors, all religions, all cultures, say to me, seeing you on television knew I could make it. You were the biggest role model in my life because you were a woman of color who was proud of her color. You're a woman of color who paved the way for us. When I was on television back in those days, I ensured that the broadcasters had representation on the screen. I didn't feel because I had made, I was popular, got into a position where people knew me, I was famous. I didn't think I'm all right. I thought, hang on, there are people out there who it isn't all right for them. And I want to be their voice. And I want to make the people working around me realize that you have to consider people like yourself and children growing up, not feeling as if they're part of the bigger world, part of society. So I've always, always, always been a role model and paving the way. I campaigned for Minister for Children for 20 years. Back in 1983, I started, and I campaigned for Minister for Children so that government can have joined our policies until we finally got one in 2003. I've campaigned to get children's picture books, recognizing the diversity of our country, if not the world. I've campaigned for television programs to better reflect the diversity of our country. And I've never, ever been afraid to speak out, because I know there's people like you watching that I want to motivate, to inspire, and for you to go out and change the world, for me to pass on the baton. And I think today is another day of me passing on the baton to you. I don't want to hear you say any more negative words about your situation. You are in a privileged situation. Privileged because you know in your mind that there is a purpose in life, and your purpose is to change the world. And I want you to see yourself as a leader. And when you're a leader, you have to suffer. A true leader can feel pain. A true leader knows what it feels like to be the underdog. A true leader has the vision to change the world for other people. And I want you to see yourself as a leader. I never thought when I came to Britain, how people treated me. People would spit at me as I walked down the street. Grown men would lift my skirt up and say, "Where's your tail monkey?" My sister and I have been once standing on a railway station, and a train comes in, and these men pulled down the window in the carriage they were in, got their private parts and tried to pee on us. Those are the kinds of indignity I had to go through. I'd go to a shop and they wouldn't get served. They didn't serve black people. And my mum would say, "You go back to the shop and you wait until they serve you." That taught me to be resilient. That taught me how to figure out who was going to get at me. That taught me how to drive myself forward. And everything I do, I know I have to face those same indignities in different forms. Like when I was a chancellor of the University of Exeter, the first black woman chancellor in this country in 2006. And when I became the chancellor, people used to say, "How can someone like you be a chancellor of such a fine university?" Because Exeter is one of the top universities in the country. "How can someone like you be something like that?" And I'd say, "Because I have empathy and understanding. How can someone like you talk the way you do? I need you to join forces with me to make Exeter an even greater place." I always come back with something. I always come back with a positive answer to what people are telling me, not negative. Because I know what they're doing is trying to put me down and blow me off the course, but I won't let it happen. Now I'm standing in Parliament on the land, the people who put my ancestors in slavery, the people who decided the fate of my ancestors. I am now standing in that same place on the red benches, dictating and deciding about legislation in the country today that will affect you and your children and your grandchildren. Who would have thought, after 400 years, here I am. And when I'm there, I'm always every opportunity I get, I talk about Bernardo's. Every opportunity I get, I talk about children and the inequalities that people have to go through. I use every opportunity to do that because I've had a journey, not just personal journey, but also the journey of my ancestors, dating back from my father, his father, his father, his father, his mother. That's what I do. And that's what I want you to do in life as well. And that's why Bernardo's is there to pave the way for other young people like yourselves, pave the way for as many people as possible to make sure that they have a future. So you are lucky. You are lucky to have fallen under the umbrella of Bernardo's, because without Bernardo's, what would have happened to you? Where would you be? You're being looked after. You are blessed. And when you feel like that, life is easy. Bring it on. What next? You know, and that's the excitement of life. The excitement of knowing that there is a bright future waiting for you, that you can change other people's lives.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode, the very first of our oral history project. If you or a family member have a story to tell, a connection with Bernardo's, and come from a post-war African and Caribbean community in Britain, your voice could feature in this podcast. We'll announce when this opens up, so stay tuned by subscribing to this podcast wherever you're listening to it. If you enjoyed it, a review would always be appreciated. We'd love to hear from you. For more information on the project and to hear more from Floella, please visit the Oral History Project website at www.bernardos.org.uk/oral-history-project. Thank you.